वाहिगुरु जी का खालसा, वाहिगुरु जी की फतेह।
वाहिगुरु जी का खालसा, वाहिगुरु जी की फतेह।
फतेह सर, लास्ट नाइट वी पुट अप अ आर्टिकल ऑन द ब्लॉग व्हिच डिस्कस्ड सिक्खी एंड अडल्ट्री, एंड द रिस्पॉन्स वेरीड फ्रॉम एक्सट्रीमली पॉजिटिव टू डाउन राइट पेजोरेटिव। एंड वन ऑफ द रिस्पॉन्सेस वी गॉट वॉज फ्रॉम समवन हु क्लेम्स देयर पार्ट ऑफ अ Sikh Sampradaya, which does idolatry. And just before we start, their exact wording was that you guys are a bunch of fuddus for promoting all this, and I would like to respond to them. Well, thank you, Paji, for telling us we are part of your family, but where do we sign the disown papers? See, if they had some guts, they would have actually put this up as a comment and they would have actually done this publicly, you know. So even if they have an account under another presumed with them, but right down to, you know, being downright offensive to us, then we would hold back as well, you know, because we all have human dignity. And if you guys think that we're below animals for, you know, saying what we say, for having our views, then don't worry about it. We will also treat you. We will treat you differently. We won't rip away your dignity, but if you really think that we're going to stand there and allow you to call us fuddus, well, then yes, we're just going to pretty much point it right back at where you got those values and virtues which make you a fuddu from anyway. And like they say, it takes one to know one. Anyhow, so what happened was that initially speaking, there was no plan to actually, you know, do a episode on the same thing as, you know, what we wrote on the blog. However, in light of this statement, we decided otherwise. So now here's the thing we have. We discussed in a previous episode how in the 20s the Tat Khalsa cleaned up the precincts of the Darbar Sahib and took the idols out from there.
Yep.
And after that, it sort of galvanized Mahatma Gandhi, Dayananda, and many others into action against the Sikhs, because up till that point, they had been using quite a lot of elements to say Sikhs were Hindus and disparaging Sikhi outright. But when Sikhs started fighting back for their own rights to defend their ethos, their philosophy, it didn't sit well with many. And we can see a similar thing at play today. If we're out there giving langar, we are all good. If we stand up for our kakars, we are fanatics, fundamentalists, anarchists, extremists, buckies, or whatever the hell they call us. Keeping that in mind, we also need to remember something which is going to be quite offensive to many sentiments. Well, what I'm about to say, what we're about to discuss, is that the Sikhi of today, if you look at how we understand the Sikhi of today, there is a fundamental, a radical difference between the Sikhi of today and the Sikhi of yesteryear. Now, the Sikhi of the past was able to produce, you know, warriors and statesmen like, you know, Baba Banda Singh Bahadur, Mata Sahib Kaur, you know, Nawab Kapoor Singh. That Sikhi was also able to finish us with Guru Gobind Singh, who was, you know, who lived as the template for Guru Nanak's Khalsa. How they understood Sikhi would have been light years apart from the Sikhi which, you know, we have been fed since the past 200 years.
Agree with your statement right there. 100%
Right?
agree.
100%. Now, the thing is, if we were to say even a little thing, it suddenly becomes you're looking at it from a, you know, post-colonial perspective, you're looking at it from an Abrahamic perspective, you're looking at it from a British perspective. The same people who say this to us are arguing that Sikhs used to do havan, Sikhs are dharmic, Sikhs believe in reincarnation, Sikhs believe in Vedas. And every June, now that June is coming up, they will be the first ones out there to take pakoras at the, you know, 1984 pog and say that what happened to them was very, and we will agree on this, what happened was extremely, you can say, inimical, extremely, you know, I guess to put it simply, bad for the community. It was sanguinary for the community. It was a holocaust for the community. But at the same time, these guys will be turning around and saying Sikhs are a vakhri kaum. And then for the rest of the year, for the other 11 months, Sikhs are not a vakri kaum. Call it the hypocrisy, and you suddenly become a Calvinistic, you know, someone with a Calvinistic perspective, Abrahamic perspective. At the end of the day, all this so-called academic intellectual debate, it's just hollow words being thrown around Nothing is coming out of it. It isn't making anyone a Sikh.
I agree with you, and you also have to identify that. I think in some previous podcast, I think I have asked you this question: what's the difference between insult and description?
You're right. You're right.
So here, they can also call you that you are doing a nindya
Yes.
of their so-called sampradaya. It's an important question. What's the difference between a description and an insult?
See, this has really come down to the fact how much of a free speech is a free speech if he can't criticize what we believe to be wrong. And if we criticize it, then we should be getting a reply trying to at least justify what we think is wrong. Or at the very least, they should be, telling us that, this is why you guys are wrong, rather than, grabbing pitchforks and running straight for the, internet to tell us we're fuddos.
Yeah. From his or from that guy's perspective, he's describing us that we are fuddos. Yeah, you have to understand from his perspective, yeah.
Yep, you need to understand from his perspective. And I wonder if there's any sort of a manuscript out there which justifies this language, being used by them. If someone like us was to use that language, I mean, the fact we have said fudu now, imagine how many, snippets they can just take out of this one thing and sort of lambast us with it, crucify us with it. And then if it's someone who's one of them, they just, instantly hold their peace that, at the most, galjugi phera pagas yaglete.
Well, it's almost like you have an excuse ready for everybody. Well, they have an excuse ready for everything and every single incident. Kaljugi fera, man.
Yep. Now the
Amazing.
yep.
I murdered somebody. Oh, sorry, Kaljugi fera.
Galjugi phera, go to Amritsar and have, Ishnan and Ram Das Sarovar nate, Sabutre Pap Kamat. And these sort of things, when you're thinking about it, when they misinterpret Gurbani, and that's something we will be talking about today, is how they've misinterpreted Gurbani and also the verses of Bhai Gur Das. Now you would think that, among them there is no general agreement as to what is Amrit Vela. One faction is saying that it's at 12 o'clock, another is saying it's at 3 o'clock, and another is saying it's 6 o'clock. And then they, routinely say that you need to get to that point where you have enough powers to, super teleport yourself to Darbar Sahib, have Ishnan there, and then come back and attend such kind when you do Amrit Vela. And you're left wondering that, when they say you wake up in the morning to do this Amrit Vela Ishnan, that's when the gates of such kind happen, open for you. So for one faction, these gates close at 11:55 in the night. For the other faction, they close at 2:55 in the morning. And then the last faction, they close at 5:55 in the morning. So, literally, who are we to accept as being, the most authentic ones?
I think I remember something from Jordan Peterson, yeah?
Yep.
And it was about based on 1984, the novel.
Yes, by Orville.
Yeah, George Orwell. And okay, so he said that there's a revolution, and then there's a counter-revolution, and the people who say, okay, we're even better Marxists than these people have lost the plot, yeah? So they get even more radical after, let's say, a few years. Those counter-revolutionaries suffer another revolution where the new people say, we are even much more better Marxists or communists than these people. So along the
So
same lines,
yep.
our Amrit Vela is at 6 a.m. No, ours is at 5 a.m. No, ours is at 4 a.m. No, you're all wrong. Ours is at 3 a.m. You know? And it might get to a point where the Amrit Vela might be at 8 p.m.
It might get to a point where at the end of the day you drop down dead from fatigue because you aren't even sleeping.
So if you happen to be working at night, let's say, what's your Amrit Vela?
Well, I mean, that's the thing. That's the thing. If you're working at a shift and you get off your shift at around 6 o'clock and you do your Pat Puja, then and then you go to sleep, but the gates of Sachkhand are, closing at 5:55 a.m., then what's in it for you?
New job.
You see, and these are the sort of contradictions. These are the sort of contradictions which mistranslations of Gurbani lead to. Now, the Amritsar Sarovar, Ram Das Sarovar, Nate Shabad, and there are many other Shabads which, they mistranslate to say it's the physical Amritsar. And we discussed this in the Darbar episode that it says this physical Amritsar, you need to go and have a bath. Now, the fact is that, when Guru Ram Das wrote some of those Shabads, there was no Amritsar at the time. And then before Guru Ram Das, there was Guru Amar Das, Guru Angad, Guru Nanak. There was no Amritsar at that time. So does that mean that the Sikhs and their Sangats were all sinners for not going to the physical Amritsar, which didn't even exist then? But if you're saying that that Amritsar is an adjective, then why can't it be an adjective for later generation of Sikhs? And the reality is that for their own money, for their own stomachs, for their own businesses, they've made this very handsome system.
Yep.
But those contradictions are coming out now, and that's what we're going to be focusing on, is one of those contradictions. So what actually incited this reaction from our, friend who, I have a mind to call him Mr. Fudu, but I'm not going to call him that. Let's just, call him Mr. F. Now, it seems Mr. F seems to be opposed to us saying that idolatry is not a Sikh practice.
He's opposed to this idea that Sikhs are not idol worshippers.
Yep. Now, okay, so let's just put it into context down here. Why idolatry? How did it enter the human psyche, and why did it strike roots so deep? And what is idolatry in the first place? So, the common definition of the practice is that it consists of shaping mundane objects to substitute for the divine presence, and then, worshipping them. Now, what we have is that in the Kaaba in Islam, we have that, meteoritic stone, which they, claim that it was touched by Abraham, so they will worship that. Then on the other hand, we have Hindu society, which has a lot of, gods and goddesses, polytheism, and they have a lot of idols as well. Now, just like, Greek society and Roman society before them. Now, the irony down here, which it comes down to, is that, the first question Gurbani has for us is that Vaheguru Akal Purakh, God, creator, whatever you want to call him, he, or let's just say they, Vaheguru gave us a form, right? And this form came about as a result of Waheguru designing us, over time. And let's see, we started from apes, we, became Homo sapiens, and we progressed further, 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 further. Today, speaking physically, our body is probably one of the weakest on the in all of creation, but our brain is the most formidable in all of creation as well. Now, when we say that our maker has the same form as us, this brings us to one thing, that if the maker has the same form as us, if we didn't evolve over time, then where are our imperfections coming from?
Man, you're making some heavy points today. Well, as
Just
always.
listen to this point down here. Now, according to Christianity, according to Islam, according to Hinduism as well, all these faiths, conventional faiths, all these dogmatic faiths, some super creator formed us in his own image. I mean, the Vaishnav school of Hindu thought believes this, and not the, the other thoughts, but we will get onto Vaishnavism as soon and why it's only a transitionary school. Anyhow, they believe that God created us in his image. So if he created us in his image, where do our defects come from? And then the claims are made that there's a devil, Iblis, or there are some, demonic people. And that's where it comes down to the fact that believe in our cult. If you don't, then you will always be subject to these demonic natures, etc., etc. And if you look at the fundamentalist preachers in the Bible Belt, even today they say that God gets angry. So if God gets angry, man has the right to get angry. And if you're defining your anger as being righteous because you're a Christian and your Christian God is the true God, and that God is angry and you can get angry as well, you have the right to get angry because you worship a God capable of getting angry, then what is stopping someone else from using that same logic on you? That, if your God is getting angry, my God gets angry as well. Hey, I'm pretty pissed off that you don't believe in my angry God. Stuff your angry God. You see where these quandaries lead us to? We're at each other's throats. And if God is in physical form, now why have we been given a physical form? So there's a general consensus in the religious world that this physical form is for doing, godly stuff. In Hinduism, it might be, meditating your life away. In Christianity, it might be, just becoming a conformist. In Islam, obviously, it's spreading the faith. But if God has given us this physical form, then, what use is God's own physical form to God himself?
I don't have answers to all these questions. You must think about them for at least a week or something. Then maybe write down an answer, try to refine it.
And so don't they. They don't have answers as well.
So they just try to insult you and walk away.
That's why these faiths have that, strict emphasis on, totalitarianism, mental totalitarianism that you can't think. See, the fundamental thing is, okay, so let's take it, the creator is in human form, but if the creator is hampered by vice and virtue because of that human form, then is humanity's imperfectness static and perfectness only an illusion? And the thing is that the irony in all this is that we are trying to imagine God as being one of us.
So the man created God in his image.
Man created God in his image. Now, obviously, this will, not allow us to grasp reality. Now, in Sikhi, what Baba Nanak tells us is that we have come through countless janams. Now, these janams are not in the past sense to spot reincarnation, but in the present sense. So, what he's actually saying is that as we evolved over time, we have base traits. Fallen traits from the animals we evolved from. Man is essentially an animal until he starts, utilizing his intellect. And Waheguru is formless. Now, based on the reincarnation, issue, we will say that, man's physical form is the highest of all the animals, of all the beasts. Man's physicality is the highest because man can, think for himself.
We
On the
got the
other
brain.
hand, yep. On the
We have
other
the
hand,
brain.
yep. And Gurbani also, tells us, by Prabhat Manuk Dioria, Gobindam Lanki Eteri Paria. But Gurbani doesn't say that, by Prabhat Manuk Dioria, Gobindam Lanki Eteri Paria. What that really means is that you have been given this human body to meet the Creator. It never says that, no one else can create the creator, etc. What it says is that we are at that stage of mental evolution where we can imbibe the virtues of our maker. Waheguru is formless. Waheguru created the world. In this world, we see Waheguru's hukam at play. The impartiality of hukam is a virtue, and whatever else comes from that impartiality, those virtues we are supposed to live by. That is called living in the godly way. And not, imagining God to be a fearsome, beast who's going to whip your ass if you don't go to church on Sunday or the mosque on Friday or the Gurdwara on Wednesday, whatever, superstitions they have. Now, the fact down here is that since all these things came along, since man made God in his image, we have actually come down to, several points down here. So the first one is that prior to the Sikh gurus, we had, the 15 Pagats whose verses, in the Guru Granth Sahib oppose idolatry. And foremost among them is, Kabir. And Kabir, as we discussed previously, is very pointed in his criticism. So he has a verse in Asa Shri Kabir Jiyo Ki Panchpadi Nomi Dhutkai Panjwa Ek Yonkar Sadhguru Prasad Pati Tor Maline Pati Pati Jiyo जिस पहन को पाठी तोड़े सो पहन निर्जयो भूले मालनी है ये हो सतगुर जागता है ते हो रहाओ ब्रह्म पठी बिसन ददरी फूल शंकर देव तीन देव प्रत्यक्ष तोड़े करे किसकी सियो पखन गर्त का मूर्त कीने ताय का सहित पाओ जे एह मूर्त सच है तो घरनहारी खाओ. Now what it really says is that starting from the start of this verse, because this is quite a archaic language here. What Kabir is essentially saying is he's actually criticizing the people who are making idols. Now, the first thing which is used to justify idolatry is that God is in each and every microcosm of creation. Now, last time I told you about the Yajurveda, section 32.8. And what that says is that Brahman is a non-sentient force which has woven this illusion around us. And in this illusion, each and every particle is permeated by Brahman. But Brahman has no intention in making creation. So because Brahman is non-sentient, we need to emulate this non-sentient science by, meditating your life away and dissolving our individual self in this Brahman. So, dissolving yourselves into nothingness, there's no point to life. We are here by an accident. And
Life is suffering, yeah.
life is suffering. Now, what's happened is that this Vedic thought is quite heavy for many individuals. So Vaishnavism came along as a more or less sort of a personalized form of this. So according to Vaishnavism, while this is all an illusion, fundamentally speaking, Brahman has also precipitated the creation or the birth of demigods like, Krishna, Ram, Chandra, Vishnu, Brahma, Shiva, etc., etc. And these preserve and posit
Positive men.
humanity on the path towards Brahman. Krishna comes to save the Vedas, Ramchandra comes to save the Vedas, etc. And what Guru Nanak says in Japji Sahib is Ekka mai jukt vyatan chales parvan ek sansar ek pandar ek lai diban jiv tis pave te ve chalave jiv hove farman o ve kyo na nadar nave bhote vidan. Now, the way our lot translate this nowadays is Ekka mai. And they're saying mother. One mother created three disciples to ensure the function of creation. And this mother usually is a, and I'm trying to do my best impression down here, vocal impression, Shri Chandi Ji, Mata Adi Shakti Ji, Osade Shastra Chebi Hundiya Ji. But what Guru Nanak is saying, reality, if you look at the Gurmukhi grammar and the context, is that one illusion has started this little jugat, this little methodology, which leads us to believe that there are three facets of creation. And these three are controlled by three disciples. So, Brahma creates, Shiva destroys, Vishnu preserves. And you find this replete in all other cultures and faiths as well, the so-called Divine Trinity.
That's the
And what
reason why
in.
you have so many Shiva temples, but I think there's only one Vishnu temple or Brahma temple.
Yes. But what Guru Nanak is saying is that this is just an illusion. So, one illusion, Ekka Maya. One illusion has started all this, and this illusion or delusion has convinced us that these three exist. Jivtis pave teve chalave. Now, this next line is quite crucial because this comes after the Punjabi substitute, the Gurmukhi version of a full stop. And what it's saying is Jivtis pave teve chalave jo hove farman. Now, this is directly addressed to Vaheguru Akal Purakh, that there is a creator who has infinite intelligence. Whatever this creator wishes transpires, and that farman, that royal order, that royal decree is always carried out. That we can't see this hukam, this will, even though this farman exists. Look at the wonder here, that there is a will powering creation, but we can't see the will in action, only the results of it. And you see how this one mistranslation, this one deliberate mistranslation, has led us down this other path. And by Ratha Singh Ji Narankari, who was the descendant of Baba Dayal Singh Narankari back during Maharaja Ranjit Singh's time, Shamsher Singh Ashok records. Now, here's a differentiation we need to make, is that these aren't the modern Narankaris. These were before them. They split off from these Narankaris because these Narankaris had a characterless, leader. Anyhow, the original Narankaris, Baba Ratha Singh Ji, was invited to the Akal Takht to discuss the matter of Ardas. Ek Onkar Shri Vaheguru Ji Ki Fateh, Shri Bhagwati Ji Sahib, even though Ardas was different back in the day. And this was exactly what Baba Ratha Singh Ji had said to Kem Singh Bedi at the time, that on one hand, we are saying that Devi was using her hair to wipe Dev, Guru Nanak Ji. And now we are saying that Guru Gobind Singh was compelled to worship the same Devi to create the Panth Khalsa. And why is it that Akal Purakh's power is now divided from Akal Purakh, and we have given it an organic form and a self, when in reality Baba Nanak is saying that ove kyo na nadar nave bhote vidan jiv tis pave teve chalave jiv hove farman. What's more supreme? Everything comes out of Akal Purakh's hukam. So why then are we taking this power and saying that this is some other power?
So if you would, let's say, go into a pagan society, you might find them worshipping a tree or something, yeah? Maybe a tree, maybe a river, they might worship the sun.
Yep, and I'll get onto that. I'll get onto that soon. But the original bhakt Kabir Shabad we are discussing, which I had to digress from, what bhakt Kabir essentially is saying is you tear off the leaves. He's addressing this to a gardener. So you tear off the leaves, but then you say in each and every leaf, there is life. The stone idol for which you tear off those leaves, that stone idol is lifeless. And now, obviously, the gardener has turned around and said to Bhakt Kabir that you're saying contradictory statements. How does this make sense? So this is the next verse. And this you're mistaken. That's what Bhakt Kabir now says to the gardener. The true guru, Satguru Jagat Hai Tyo, what that means is that the truth is the living Lord. You say, now this is, Bhakt Kabir saying this to the gardener. You say Brahma is in the leaves, Vishnu is in the branches, and Shiva is in the flowers. So when you break these three gods to worship those gods as you claim, whose service are you performing? He's not saying that these three actually exist or they, actually are in the, in creation or that they are even real. What he's saying is that you claim all your gods permeate reality. So why then do you damage one facet of reality to worship another singular facet of reality? The sculptor carves the stone and fashions it into an idol, placing his feet upon its chest. So, if the stone god was real, wouldn't it eat the sculpture for this?
Yeah.
Bhat pet arlapsi karkara kasar po ganhare po ges mort ke moksh shahar. You know that all the rich delicacies you offer to this idol. And you know that in reality, only ashes go into the mouth of the idol while the priest, the Brahmin, enjoys everything else.
Well, the Brahma has a divine right to enjoy it because he is a Brahmana.
And this is where the hypocrisy of idolatry is being, highlighted by Bhakt Kabir straight away. He's saying that, look at it. You're saying God is in each and every facet of creation. So why not worship the entire creation rather than worshiping one singular object? It might be a simplistic point, but it's a very pointed and fundamentally speaking, quite an effective point.
It is, in fact, of course.
Now, where Kabir leaves off, that's where Bhakt Namdev takes up. Now, he was even more sarcastic towards idolatry. Now, this is what Bhakt Namdev has to say. Eka pathar tije pao. दूजे पत्थर तरिया पाओ जे ओहे देओ तो ओ भी देवा कहे नाम देओ हम हर की सेवा. So what he's saying is that, okay, so you take one stone, carve it up and worship it. So one stone is God and another one we step upon and walk upon and do whatever we want to do upon it. So if one stone is divine and you're saying that God is in all stones, then why don't you use all stones to, represent God? So if there is God in one stone, then in the other one, is he barren?
Not just stone. I think the stone is it's a metaphor here, yeah.
The stone might be a metaphor, but I guess in one way it's a metaphor as well as, something practical of what he's saying here. Really, let's just say the stone might be a metaphor for image anyhow. So it can be an image, besides the stone, because, we a lot have a habit of saying that, oh, well, it's only talking about stones and not timber. Next thing you know, they start worshipping timber murti.
Could be timber murti, could be even paintings or pictures. That's my point. It's not just stone, that there's no way of getting around it. Okay, they're talking about stone. We can't worship stones. We can definitely worship pictures, and people do in our houses. You must have seen them.
And Gurdwaras as well.
Yeah, of course.
So basically, for the Bhakts, the issue was that, there is one formless God who made the entire creation. So why are we worshipping something else altogether? Why are we worshipping only one facet of that creation? Now, of course, Some people say that for the gurus, it doesn't matter how you worship God as long as you have a pure heart. You have heard that one as well, eh?
The Dil Sachata, of course.
Yeah. Now, the Sikh gurus were more direct in their opposition to idolatry. And as far as the pre-Sikh era was concerned, there was some grasp of, one directive creative potency, but this potency was disjointed into countless sub-potencies to justify that, the one singular creative potency had no interest in utilizing itself. So, like we discussed, Eksansarik, Pandarik, Levi, Banerjee, these three came about because, Brahman was unfeeling. Brahman wasn't even humanistic in any sense of the term. So, you needed something people could relate to. So it was decided that there are minor demigods who ensure creation keeps on running. So, here's the contradiction. Now, if you think about it, Brahman has no point in taking interest in creation. But the common worshipper needs to feel that there is some divine power above him which takes interest in his affairs and which he can placate to achieve his life's desires. So obviously, there came these demigods who were created by unfeeling Brahman, who didn't intend to create them, and they ensured creation was running. But at the same time, they also answered mankind's plea. In turn, if mankind followed their path and ultimately disilluted themselves in Brahman. So, quite a beautiful system, isn't it?
Works well for them.
And you can find a precedence for this in everything, even in ancient Greece, Rome. You can find it in all cultures which have idolatry. Now, so what we're saying is one god, or not even one god, one creative potency divided into a million countless others.
Avatars, you, the word is used here.
Yep, necessary illusions, pretty much. Now, here was the quid pro quo relationship down here that, I need to dissolve myself in reality, and this reality means that the current reality, this creation, is all false. But to do that, I need some solace in life. I need to be posited on the right path. I need to have faith. So how do I get to this, point of faith? I need to placate these sub-potencies, which represent one microcosm of that other reality. So when Vaishnav Bhakti came along, idolatry really took off. Because come to think about it, and I'll get onto this, in the next one down here, is that idolatry really takes God out of man and puts him somewhere else. So there is a God and he's on another plane. Now, all societies where idolatry transpires, have you realized that those societies don't value the concept of human oneness?
Well, I know they don't.
If you think about it, ancient Greece, ancient Rome, all other idolatrous civilizations, they have a bit of a hierarchy going on, like, the caste system or the priestly classes, et cetera, because really you're taking the divinity out of yourself, putting it on another pedestal, and on that pedestal, then you're saying that, that divinity is worth your worship. The common man is, on a very descendant plane when compared to that divinity. The divinity is higher than the common man. So you can easily see that the oneness of mankind, which is rooted on that there is that divine infinite spark of, singularity within us because we are created by one creator, is no more left in man. It's taken out straight away.
Yeah, but it is yeah. It's a very good observation. It's also, let's say, a direct question to the people who believe in idolatry.
So man is made less than man. You understand what I mean?
Man.
Because that potential, that theory of potential, man having infinite potential, is suddenly destroyed straight away. Because really, what's being said is that you don't have that potential because you don't have the divinity within you.
It lies somewhere else.
Now, this is not to say that man is God. But what I'm essentially saying is that, there is godliness about men. You see what I mean down here? Man can emulate God's attributes, positive attributes at least, if you talk about idolatry. But that unification, that unity, that, uniting sense is suddenly taken away altogether. I mean, we, in those societies, I mean, it's easy to argue those societies have been revolutionary, but in a way, if you look at it, those societies speaking internally, there is a lack of empathy which defines them. Consider it for a few minutes. Consider it for a few minutes.
Well, that's why I've been largely silent for the past 5, 10 minutes, because I'm trying to think. You're just putting point after point after point.
Because this lack of empathy, now here's another thing. This empathy is directed towards somewhere else. And now this is going to be something you're going to like. So this empathy is actually divided into nine components, and all these components are directed towards the idol. Now it's argued that the idol is a substitution, but a focal point substitution for the divine presence. Again, if you look at Bhakt Namdev and Kabir Shabbats, we will understand that, even this is quite disingenuous logic, dubious logic, because the divine presence is all around us, it is within us, but rather than realizing that divine presence, we are focusing it somewhere else. So how this has been sundered is the fact that what's been introduced is something called Prema Bhakti. Bhakti means devotion in a simplistic sense, that then prema means love. And this is how prema bhakti happens. So these are the nine modes described from, Upanishadic and Vedic literature. So first, developing faith in the deity. Two, associating with only that deity's adherents. Three, performing devotional service for the deity and its residents. Four, relinquishing worldly responsibilities in the name of the deity. Five, augmenting faith in the deity through music and otherwise. Six, only ever discussing the deity. Seven, full attachment to the deity and no one else. Eight, solely retaining love for the deity. And nine, mental dissolution into the deity and ultimately the root Brahman.
Okay.
Now, this is called Prema Bhakti. And I guess in Sikhi, it's called the nine limbs of Chandi. And Dr. Daljeet Singh pointed out the problem with these FCs to it, that they do all the stuff for the Guru Granth, but do they live the moral life which the Guru Granth Sahib emphasizes we live?
Well, you know the answer to the question very well, Mr. Singh.
Mr. F already gave it to us last night. See, so that's the one. These nine things see us doing a lot of funny stuff like, washing weapons with milks, etc., etc. Now, the Sikh gurus identified two problems with idolatry. They thought more deeply than the Bhakts. So, the first one, of course, it nullified the requisite for ethicality and morality by separating the divine and the human planes. So, the creator is actually divorced from the creator's divinity. Which is within men is divorced from men. So obviously we are talking about, the oneness of humanity being destroyed by adultery. Because if indeed the maker is on the outside and not on the inside, then by rights there was no commonality of humankind, as there was no existing innate relationship between one human and the next. So from this problem comes the next problem. Now, one thing you will notice about civilizations which practice idolatry, somewhere along the way they started as monotheists, then they went to polytheism. And there was a explosion point within them where, multiple gods and goddesses were born. It's common across all cultures and civilizations which practice idolatry. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I'm trying to think about the examples of ancient Greece. I'm not too sure about what happened in ancient Egypt, but I think I get your point.
So now, if we were to define polytheism as being the worship of multiple gods in lieu of one, That's a very simplistic definition. Now, the reality behind polytheism's existence is that it diversifies ethicality to the degree that ethics and morals become entirely relative. So the problem is the gurus perceived it was a classic case of dogmatic hypocrisy. So society still requires some degree of ethics to provide solace with the vision of justice. So if we take it in the, Indian case, the Indic case, justice was mostly the mainstay of the elite castes. Then, in other idolatrous civilizations, it belonged to the ruling elite. All these head honchos were free to choose which ethic to believe in at whim. So if one creed or deity proved too stringent, another could be adopted. So with each deity, with each god came its own relative set of ethics. So really what we're saying is that if man makes God, then man obviously makes the God's virtues. And you're free to choose which virtue you want or not.
If you were to imagine God as a human being, what qualities or what virtues would he or she have?
See, now this is where we are aiming for. Now, in an idolatrous society, you would be free to decide what virtues and ethics you want God to have.
Is that God going to have human virtues or something else?
Now, that's the thing. That's the thing, because if you're saying one God, diversified into multiple gods and goddesses, etc., 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 and you can worship them in an image form, then obviously, if you're giving God a form, you're free to give God, morals and ethics. So what I'm essentially saying is, where society is concerned, because the Sikh gurus thought very deeply about this, where society was concerned, there was no static set of ethics and morals. Ethics and morals were always changing. And you see, and you see this in the caste system. You see this in the caste system as well, compartmentalized set of ethics for each caste.
Yep, I got your point. Yep.
So, I mean, if you look at it, the most fundamental case, the most non-profound case we can quote is that of the Aztec civilization. So, Aztec priests only buff-fed the day they were born. After that, they used to, wear human skin and human organs as their clothes for the rest of their lives. And then, if you look at it, they were the gods, they were the priests of Hummingbird, the, primary Aztec deity. Then you had the priests of the Star Slayer who, used to bath every day, etc. It's just, you see, even it turned down to the fact that, as far as the priests of Hummingbird were concerned, if you were walking down the street and they looked at you, they could order you killed, while the others did not have that, regulatory power, because their set of ethics was very different from Hummingbird's ethics. Hummingbird was the god of war.
The
So you
smallest
see,
bird was the god of war.
yep. So you see what I mean? The different set of ethics, there's no one yardstick with which you can judge society. People are free to do whatever they want to. And obviously, this is how an underclass will be born, which is always suffering. I mean, take, for example, Sparta. In Sparta, we had the helots, if I remember the term correctly, the slaves.
Oh, the slaves here.
And Spartans, when they used to train, their mission usually used to be was to go there, find a family of helots and kill them.
There was a lot more going on, but that was a part of it here, as well, as far as I know.
That was part of it. Now, if you look at Athens, if you were born retarded in Athens or handicapped, they would still try to make something of you. In Sparta, you would just be thrown off a cliff.
They will stamp your butt first.
Two different set of ethics going there. And there's a silent underclass who suffers the most. You see how these examples, multiple examples of these societies, because if you're worshipping, idols, it's not just the act of idolatry, which is, ultimately denuding your sense of oneness, your sense of divinity, which is annihilating it. It's also the very concept, the deep philosophical connotations of idolatry, which destroy your society. And this is why Guru Arjan wrote a very, very profound Shabad. And this is what he actually says. Ghar mein thakur nazar na aave, gal mein pahan le latkave. Par mein pula saakt firta, niro birlo, birlo khap khap marta rahau. Jis pahan ko thakur kahata, o pahan le usko dobda. Gunhar lon लून हरामी पहाड़ नाव ना परगरामी गुड़ मिल नानक ठाकुर जाता जल तल महियल पूर्ण विदाता. So what he's actually saying is that the idiot fails to perceive the maker within. Now, what he's saying is that don't close your eyes and, do Vaheguru, Vaheguru to see the God within. What he's saying is that the idiot fails to perceive that the maker's intelligence and attributes are within him and within everyone else. They're within humans. So what this idiot does is he hangs an image around his neck to remember whatever he associates with whoever he believes to be God. And like a cynic, he wanders helter-skelter, forever plagued by doubt. So, if he doesn't like one God doesn't listen to him, he can go to the next God, etc., etc., etc. Adopt a different set of ethics and morals. And what he's doing is he's churning water. If he churns milk, he gets butter, but here he's churning water and getting bubbles. And this is how he wastes his life. The stone he declares his God, that stone ultimately drowns him mentally. Why be untrue to your own innate self? Bites of stone only sink. By accepting the truth, we realize our true maker, that perfect maker permeates anything and everything.
Okay, so we are nearly, well, quarter, three quarters on, three fourths of an hour in.
So you see, the problem with a society which practices idolatry is that it takes the God out of the man, makes the man give God virtues and ethics which aren't even God's, and at the end of the day, it sets man on the path to destruction. Such societies are never able to progress mentally or philosophically.
I think we had a little bit of a connection issue. I was going to ask you a question that
Yes.
let's talk about some serious points. What form of idol worship are we as Sikhs involved in today?
So what happened was that during the Singh Sabha era, Gyani Dit Singh was confronted by Swami Dayanand on this very point. Now, the initial debate between Dayanand and Dit Singh hadn't gone well for Dayanand because Dayanand was a colonial product. So he was trying to cast Brahman as a sentient god. And what had happened was Gyani Dit Singh also knew about the Vedas as well, and he was sitting debating with Dayanand, and he asked Dayanand, so how did Ishwar create creation? And Dayanand said, well, then Ishwar created it through the four elements which existed before Ishwar. And Dayanand had pretty much pointed out, so, well, your Ishwar is like a laborer or a woman in a kitchen. They always have the tools and utensils, but they can't create anything themselves. And people had started laughing, and Dayanand had gotten really angry because if Dayanand had continued this line of thought further, as Gyani Dit Singh relates in his, Dayananda Adimera Samband, he would have been forced to admit that ultimately the Vedic creation mythos is based on Brahman, and Brahman is non-sentient. So the fact that Gyani Dit Singh was saying that Dayananda was saying there is an Ishwar like the biblical God, that entire myth would have been exposed straight away. His lie would have been caught out. Dayananda, however, didn't give up and decided to, attack Sikhi by saying that the Sikhs practice bibliotry. And this is where Gyani Dit Singh took him to the task again. We bow to the Guru Granth Sahib because it gives us gyan, practical gyan which we can live by. And the fundamental difference is that an idol is being placated to get something. Whereas in Sikhi, we bow to the Guru Granth Sahib because it teaches us how to live. So on one hand, we have a teacher, and on the other hand, we have a god, a conventional god who does nothing at all, people are wasting their time. And on the other hand, in Sikhi, we have a mentor, we have the Guru Granth Sahib. You understand what I'm meaning?
I understand, but let's allow. Okay, let's dumb it down for Mr. F and his entire family.
His entire bloody clan and his entire group. Anyhow, what I'm saying is that in Sikhi, the Guru Granth Sahib is a mentor, a practical mentor. What is an idol?
What
One
is an idol?
idol has multiple texts to it. There is no attributes connected to the idol itself that this is how to ethically live your life. One idol probably has 100 different scriptural texts attached with it. Here in Sikhi, we just have the Guru Granth Sahib. We bow down to it to show reverence. Why do we show reverence to it? Because it teaches us how to live. It mentors us. We have the Chor Sahib over it to show sovereignty, but more practically to keep, insects away from it. Any vermin. We wrap it up in clothes and we put it on a high pedestal every night for safety. Back in the day in Pakistan, when I asked, the elders from there who came from there, they told me that it usually used to be a cupboard where we used to put the Guru Granth Sahib right on the top after wrapping it up in multiple layers.
Yeah, it true.
Now, the problem is, what Dayananda identified was that Sikhs were doing Prema Bhakti to Guru Granth Sahib.
But if it wasn't wrong
And
in a sense.
that's exactly how Gyani Dutt Singh destroyed him again. But Gyani Dutt Singh also had a warning for the Sikhs. Now, we mentioned nine modes of, Prema Bhakti, or the nine limbs of Chandi, as our lot called them. The reality is that if I'm waving Chor Sahib over the Guru Granth Sahib and the Gurdwara, it's going to get me nothing. If I'm doing Langar in the Gurdwara, Langar di Seva, it's going to get me nothing.
It's going to get you fat. That's what it's going to get you.
Well, one thing. But on the basis of spiritual benefit, it's going to get me nothing. Why? Because all this is selfless seva with a practical design. Now, if our Sikhs understood this fact, Gurdwara committees would be the ones doing the, every week giving a new Rumala to Maharaj and taking care of the Gurdwara. But because our lot don't understand this, unfortunately, they're going the way of Prema Bhakti. You don't have a kid, take a Rumala to the Gurdwara. You want to get a good place in heavenly real estate when you die? Donate a few million dollars to the Guru Granth Sahib, even to the point, look at Ardas, Maharaji, so and so doesn't have a kid, please give him a kid.
Man, okay. Sorry to interrupt. Hold on.
Yep.
In some previous podcast, you mentioned Heavenly BBM,
Yep.
and now you have Heavenly Real Estate.
It's the point which I'm trying to make down here.
Well, it is used to every person who die is a Swargavasi, yeah.
Yep, even though the guy might be a real total kanjar in life, he's a Swargvasi after dying. Now, Gyani Dutt Singh debunked Dayananda that the Sikhs don't do bibliotry. But if Gyani Dutt Singh was alive today, he would take a chitter off right around us. Fine then, have a simple Chandwa Sahib, have a simple, Tara Sahib. But what do we have down here? Would the Guru really be happy with what we have here today?
I have this a thought in mind, and I think I read it a long time ago. They say that the problems they vanish, the solutions remain as traditions.
That's the point. I mean, if you think about it, during Guru Gobind Singh's time, Guru Arjan's time, how was Guru Granth Sahib kept? Did we have Chandwa Sahib of gold above it?
No, of course not.
Did we throw milk on floors while people were dying outside?
Even if they were not dying outside, there's no point throwing milk on floor.
And all this brings us to the point that what have we done today? We have brought that Prema Bhakti rubbish back into Sikhi again, and that's what Gyani Dutt Singh warned the Sikhs against. Now, here's another controversial story which is going to be pretty, burning for Mr. Ref and his type. And this one is the Thunder story, that Thunder manifested God through a rock. Have you heard that?
Be very, very careful. I'm a jack.
Now, in 1974, Dada Singh even made a film on this. He spent millions on something which didn't even really happen.
Yeah, okay. What
Now,
was the movie?
I beg your pardon?
What's the name of the movie?
Bhakt Tanna Jatt.
Oh, well, yeah. Okay, go on.
Now, these Pandra Bhakts were revolutionaries, and that's why Guru Nanak and the subsequent gurus incorporated their Gurbani into the Guru Granth Sahib, their Bani into the Guru Granth Sahib. Now, the fact was that in the 1600s, there was an individual whose name was Nabadas. And Nabadas, being the pujari he was, decided he had to corrupt the lives of all these, figures of prime importance on the subcontinent, these radicals. So the Pandra Bhakts came in for their own drubbing. Now, Bhakt Ravidas took a stand against caste discrimination by wearing the janeu.
By wearing?
The janeu.
Okay.
He was a Dalit and he wore the janeu. The Brahmins used to say the world will turn upside down, but the Ravidas wore it for a long time. Nothing happened. That's the reality. Now, according to Nabadas, Bhakt Ravidas wore a janeu and he was questioned by the Brahmins why he was wearing a janeu. And Bhakt Ravidas ripped his chest open, and inside there saw a scene in the Satyug where Bhakt Ravidas himself was a Brahmin. He committed an error and he was born a Dalit. And they decided, oh, well, look, you were a Brahmin in your past life, you can wear the
It's the same story that Bhai Vardhana drank
janeu.
brandy in his previous life.
Yep. So you see the system these individuals opposed, that same system is thrust onto them again.
If you think about it, in very simple terms, they say that you being born into the Ravidasa community is a sin. You are a
A
Brahmin.
sin.
It's a punishment for you to be born in this community.
Now let's just talk about this one point down here. It's said that Bhai Mardana used to be a yogi. He was doing tapasya when when he drank brandy and he was reborn as a Muslim Mirasi, right?
I know it's Sunday, but have you eaten way too many pakoras today?
Yes, but on the other hand, if you look at the Bhai Mardana story, let's continue with that. Bhai Mardana is born as Bhai Mardana. Why? Because he drank brandy in his old life.
His previous life, to be exact.
His previous life. If he wasn't born as Bhai Mardana, would he have met Guru Nanak?
Well, what can I say?
That's the thing. That's the thing. Now, this is actually something which happened in New Jersey. Gurbakhsh Singh Kala of Khanna was there. Same point he made once, that there was Amritdhari and he was getting a langar, and a monna was about to give him a prasad, and he said, no, meri bibek tod jaugi, because you're a monna. Gurbakhsh Singh turned around and asked him, so you're a monna to the guy giving the langar, and you're an Amritdhari to the Sikh. And he's like, yep. And he's like, is Amrit higher or being a monna? And he said, Amrit. So he said that if a monna is giving you prashada, then wouldn't your hands touching it because you're Amritdhari make it pure again?
And if a mona is strong enough to break your wrath or whatever you call it, how strong is it to begin with?
There you go. There you go. And that's actually the same thing here again. If Bhakt Ravidas wasn't born a Dalit, then would we have his words today? His stance against caste discrimination? If Mardana wasn't born as Mardana, would we have had, such a faithful companion of Baba Nanak?
Well, they might have been, I don't know, but the stories associated with them are, let's say, not false, putting it very, very lightly. Sorry, not true, putting it very, very lightly.
Now, how Nabadas decided to attack Sikhi was he decided to change, alter the legend of Bhakt Tanna. The story of Bhakt Tanna was, actually recounted by Baba, by Gurdas and his Vars. It's still there in the Dasmi Var. And so the story runs as Nabadas, says is that Bhakt Tanna goes to a Brahmin and the Brahmin gives him the stone, and Bhakt Tanna goes home and tries feeding the stone. Nothing happens. He gets angry and threatens to kill himself. And subsequently, God has to come out of the rock and eat the roti.
That's the story, yep.
And Dara Singh spent a few million, rupees making it into a super hit movie.
It always fascinates me because when you say Bhagat Ravidas, okay, Bhagat Kabir, okay, but when it comes to Tanna, Tanna Jatta.
Now, so let's look at Bhai Gurdas Iswar. Does Bhai Gurdas actually say Tanna manifested God through a rock? So let's start from the Gurmukhi, eh? First one. Brahman puja devta tanna gau charavan ave. So the Brahmin, how he earns his daily bread, is by feeding his gods. So he's tricking people into giving him food, saying that he's feeding the stone gods, but in reality, he's eating it himself. Tanna, meanwhile, earns his daily bread through honesty by being a cowherd.
Yep, he was. Yep.
Next line. Tanna pita chalta. Tanna bitha chalta, eho puche baman aak sanave. Now, what happens is that Tanna sees the difference. This is what the Gurmukhi is saying. And he invites the Brahmin to discuss the matter. Aak sanave means that he says and that he listens, and he invites the Brahmin to do the same. So there's a debate. So then the Brahmin gives a rejoinder. And this is what the Brahmin is saying now. Now, this is how clever these Mr. F types are. That what they're saying is that this is Tanna now saying that this is the next line, but in reality this is the Brahmin. What they're doing is they're deleting the past two lines when they come to this. If someone has the knowledge of Gurmukhi, they can easily catch it out that why are you guys changing the context? But there are people don't. So this is what the Brahmin is saying. Thakur di seva karo jo ichhe soi phal paave. I serve my deity, the people who I direct towards doing the same acquire their heart's wishes. Now, this indicates that the Brahmin knows about Tanna's reputation. Tanna must have had quite a reputation, and that the Brahmin is trying to, ward him off, get him away from himself, that by claiming, because obviously people have gathered around and he's trying to justify what he's doing by saying, look, I'm just, worshipping my gods, leave me alone. Tanna karda jodari me bhi deho ek jo tod pave. Now, this is where it's claimed that Bhai Gurdas is saying Tanna karda jodari, that Tanna is actually begging the rock that come out and eat my food. But what this really is that this is the Brahmin's dialogue. Tanna karda jodari me bhi deho ek jo tod paave. And what the Brahmin is saying is, Tanna, I beg of you, leave me here. If you so wish, I'll give you a stone god as well. Pathar ek lapt kar de Tanna. No gal chadave. So what he's actually done is gal chadave. Now what this means is that he wants to liberate his neck. So what Bhai Gurdas is saying, he's using adjectives here to say that Tanna has the Brahmin's neck in a very tight rope, which means he's got the Brahmin cornered.
Yep, it's
And
gone
so
corner.
what yep and so what the Brahmin has done is he's actually handed a stone to Tanna to escape himself. And then the Brahmin says, Thakranu ne valke chai re roti le pog charave. See, now my God requires a bath and sustenance. This is still the Brahmin. So he's still unable to convince Tanna, who stays there, and the people as well. He's unable to answer Tanna's logic. So this is what the Brahmin finally does. Hath jor menta karo puri pe pe bhot manave. Now he falls at Tanna's feet. He forfeits his caste status and boils down to a jat, a lower caste jat, that leave me alone. How be mehna jutal jutal me jutal si tu roti rutha tu rutha me kehona sukhave. That look, Tanna, I won't even eat my own roti because I know you're angry, so how can I convince you of my sincerity? The Brahmin still sticking to his lies. And then Tanna says, Gosaya partak hoy roti khai chai mohe mulave partak. What
Right in
Tanna
front of my
is,
eyes.
right in front of my eyes, right in front of your eyes, right in front of everyone's eyes. That's where Vaheguru Akal Purkh Gosai, that's the term Tanna uses. That's where Maharaj is. So why are you worshipping these rocks? Why are you worshipping that which Vaheguru has created? When you should be worshipping Vaheguru. And then Tanna says, how should we worship Vaheguru? Pula Pao Gobind Milave. The only way to meet Gobind is to forget your ego and live as he wants you to live. This is true worship, not by trying to honor parts of his creation.
Thinking it from the Pujari side, they just wanted to earn their, let's say, living by, tricking people and through the business of God and everything. God, sin and sorrow or whatever. So from their perspective, they're just trying to earn their bread and butter.
Now, this myth articulated, circulated in the 1600s, became a mainstay of Sikhi. By the time Sikhs came out of the jungles, there were people already believing this. But the reality is that Bhagat Tanda never manifested any god through a rock.
Not true at all.
Not true at all. And then the shrubber, the virus translated as saying God ate roti with his own hands. Now, here is what, Professor Gurtej Singh established in the 2009 Indian High Court case that, if how do we see Vaheguru in this world? We see him through humans. We see Vaheguru through humans, humans who walk in his path. And these humans, as Gurbani says, have long kesh, etc., etc. They accept their natural form. And that was one of the many arguments he made, and he won. Anyhow, to say that Vaheguru comes in the earth and takes a human form, that's anathema to Sikhi. So how come Bhai Gurdas would say the same? And this is where they bring down this logic that, your level of understanding is that, Taram Khanda, you need to be at Plana Plana Khanda, Baba Nana gave us Panch Khandas, this lot made, up to 11 Khandas. But the same logic was tried on Tanna, and Tanna refused to believe in it. So why should we believe in it?
Well, you're asking hard questions, and I fully agree with you. No, there's a never-ending, let's say, queue of excuses.
And these are the things we need to be mindful of when we need to stop committing idolatry of the Guru Granth Sahib.
Okay. What's easier for you? That you just treat Guru Granth Sahib as an idol, beg, weep, and expect good things to happen to you by giving the pujari the money? Or is it easier for you to delve into it, try to understand Guru Granth Sahib, try to understand what the Pagas are trying to say, try to understand what the Gurus are trying to say, try to understand what the Gurus lived? What's easier?
That's what Tanna is essentially saying. What is easier, making a stone image of Gobind and, saying, I worship him, and giving different deities the name of Gobind, or actually worshipping the formless Gobind who has intention beyond creating the world?
If I say, okay, if I say, let's just talk about a single verse. मिट्टी मुसलमान की पेड़े पे ही कुम्हार. Doesn't the same apply to us?
It does. It does.
It is idolatry, yeah?
It is idolatry.
So when this verse, which has been repeated many, many times by so many Pracharaks and Ragis, or let's say, preachers, why didn't the exact same verse apply to us?
Got a very valid point down there, and I mean, I guess Gurbani is more, lagu on us, more closer on us than it is on anyone else at the moment.
Look, it's more lagu on us to begin with.
If you look at it, Babaji's and Deras in Punjab now, Pok Lona, Maharaj Mu Pok Lagia, they do all these shenanigans, don't they? Which Tanna saw the Brahmin doing.
Well, they do it, and they do it in a very, very expensive kind of ceremony.
And it's come to the point now where there are idols of Tanna. Here's the irony: idols of Tanna being worshipped across Rajasthan.
Yeah, yep, true. It's happening. Sorry to say, it's happening.
And this is why we need to ultimately stick to the Gurbani of Guru Granth Sahib if you want to progress and proceed further.
Man, how do I say this? A person who spent his entire life, well, not sure about the entire life, who presented such a strong argument, the pujari turned him on his own side after he was gone by let's say mistranslating or misinterpreting what he said.
So much so that we have a fresco at Baba Atal Rai Gurdwara showing that they're now worshipping, Krishna coming out of a rock.
Why Krishna?
Who knows? I mean, they have different deities, maybe Vishnu, maybe Krishna, however they see it. The fact is that in reality, the real Tanna has been erased from history. And who knows what happened to the real Tanna?
Well, we are not even sure about what's happening today, what's happening in front of our eyes. When we have the social media, we have cell phone, we have cameras, security cameras everywhere. What's happening today, even that is being misreported. How are you sure that what happened like half a millennium ago, that was described exactly as it happened? Especially when you have a vested interest on side of a pujari.
And I guess the simplicity of Tanna was that his logic was very pointed.
A single question that will keep you awake for the rest of your remaining natural life.
A single question which would keep you screaming for the rest of your remaining life.
Well, yeah, of course. Well, it will keep you screaming if you are, let's say, dishonest to begin with. But if you want to ponder about a thought, it will keep you awake, no?
That will keep you awake. And yes, I had several pakoras at the Gurdwara today.
So, okay, for the listeners and for the family of Mr. F, if they want to trap you, they shouldn't use a honey trap. They should use a pakora trap.
Should use a pakora trap. Thank you for listening to us. Until next time, Waheguru Ji Ka Khalsa,
Waheguru
Waheguru Ji Ki
Ji Ki
Fateh.
Fateh.